You're listening to All Marine Radio on the All Warrior Radio Network. On a Wednesday. My thanks to the president of the George C. Marshall Foundation, and he's the president and CEO, Rob Havers, and for giving up his time this morning. Marshall, a fascinating guy, and probably somebody that we don't emphasize enough in our history, and we certainly should, because he smoked it. Phil Smith joins me now. Phil Smith, his name comes up a lot on this program. Smitty, I had Mike Etor on Monday. You and Mike served together. Uh-oh. Are you there? Are you there?
Yeah, hello.
Hello? All right, now.
Can you hear me?
Yeah, I can hear you. Can you hear me?
You seem to cut out every now and then.
Well, that's not me. That's you.
Okay.
You got me on speaker or some kind of nonsense.
All right, I'll take you off speaker and I'll hold the phone to my face.
I'm sorry, man. It just works better like that.
Okay, got it.
No, I had Mike Etor on Monday talking leadership. You and Mike Etor go way back.
Yeah, we do. We were platoon commanders in 2-8 with Ray Smith, and spent some time in Beirut together.
He had very favorable things to say about you, so obviously you guys have lost touch.
Well, we've been in touch. I think the last time I talked to him was right before he started his new little consultant business there. He told me he was doing it, and we kind of talked about his plan and idea on how to do that. So it's pretty cool that he's got a huge demand there in the Atlanta area for folks that need leadership. So that's good.
I just did a show on George Marshall, and Marshall is so I'd like to get your thoughts on him. Marshall's incredible. He's an incredible guy. He winds up being a staff guy during World War I. Pershing notices him. I guess he gets tagged with the nickname the Wizard because of his staff and logistical expertise in terms of moving combat power. He then comes back and is confronted with the expansion of the American, military, right, from nothing, because it hasn't existed like this before, ever. Right, and then he's got to write the war plan, the victory plan. He's got to oversee the expansion of the American industrial base. Right, and then there's the war that goes on, and so you got to pay attention to that. And then it's the Marshall Plan, and I did not realize that a huge part of the Marshall Plan was transitioning American industrial capacity from wartime to peacetime, so as to not throw a ton of people out of work that had migrated into industry in the United States. And I said, "Oh, really? George Marshall? Have you read about him? Your thoughts?"
Yeah, actually, I have. I'm in a small book club, and George Marshall by Debbie and Erwin Unger was the book we read. It's been about a year and a half or so ago. And we were interested in Marshall for a lot of reasons, but one of the reasons was he had no combat experience in World War I, just staff experience. So we were interested to try to figure out how a guy like this makes it through without combat experience at a time when the Army and the U.S. military coming up to World War II was looking for guys with experience. And of course, that's the predicament in the in-between years of war, between World War I and World War too, is where and how do you capitalize on guys that don't have experience, and what other qualifications for leadership, irrespective of where they are, might end up in the Army. So, a lot about his personality, where he was raised. A lot of his personality and characteristics do come from his family. I think they're all from the Virginia area. And so it was very enlightening. I do recommend the book. It's, maybe 500 pages long but definitely a good book, and it covers every aspect of George Marshall. So.
Yeah, he just seems like, you know, and when we talk about, you know, the need for another Marshall Plan, it was interesting talking to Rob Havers, who was on. He said, well, you know, the Marshall Plan was unique for its time. He said, so the only way you can use the term is kind of generically, because you have to understand, how he put the plan together and why it made sense in terms of American interests, American economies, European economies, and how many people, you know, had buy-in to this concept. And he said, and so it's very interesting. Very interesting. And, like I said, the Marshall Plan, I mean, Europe is just now being unsettled in a way, right, that is really the first challenge to post-World War II order in Western Europe. That was designed by George Marshall. That the stability, the peace of that was designed in his conception of not only the peace but of how it would be administered. And so to me, it's just a fascinating guy, and like all those things, the build out of the army is one, the war plan two, the expansion of the American industrial base three, just population innovations, for instance, looking at the demographics of the nation and saying women have to go to work. We have to promote that. We have to go on this Rosie the Riveter campaign, or we have to have a campaign to promote women into the workforce, because we can't do it with the numbers that we have if men remain in the workforce. And even if we do, we cannot do what we need to do without women and without mobilizing Black Americans. Now, you can imagine. Can you imagine when he said that? What?
it wouldn't go over well today.
What are you talking about? I mean, if they serve, then don't we enfranchise them? And that's not I know we've had the Civil War, but that's still not a settled issue in this country, and it wouldn't be for what 20 something years after the American Civil War. So after World War II, just a fascinating guy living in big times, and he seemed to have this gift for being able to think in the macro. The economic piece, the social piece, the military piece, all of that. He just seems like an incredible, incredible guy, and one of the great Americans of the 20th century.
Yeah, I agree. And he was operating in a period of time when we were looking for a hard, conventional objective post World War II, and then you have guys like George Kennan who say, hey, we don't want to confront the Russians. We don't want to confront the Soviets. So the Marshall Plan basically becomes not targeted against any specific country. It's targeted against hunger, desperation, the chaos of the European community. So while it helped Europeans, I think that the target, the objective was more vague, more of the hunger, the problems that were going on as a result of the war, not necessarily targeted against
Europe as a country. I saw that quote, and the quote is, I just read it last hour, but it will freeze you. It will freeze you. Our policy is directed not against any country or doctrine, but against hunger, poverty, desperation, and chaos. Its purpose should be the revival of a working economy in the world so as to permit the emergence of political and social conditions in which free nations can exist.
Yep. That's it.
Who is that guy? Is that droopy guy who stands in the back? He didn't even write his memoirs, and so it was interesting talking to the guy who came on. His name's Rob Havers. He's the president of the George G. Marshall Institute in on the campus of VMI. And he said, yeah, he said, you know, he could have helped us out by writing his memoirs, but there was such a backlash against Pershing's memoirs at the time that, you know, and Marshall was just such a humble servant that he, you know, he didn't write, in spite of all the things that he did in his life, he did not write his own memoirs. And and so, interesting play. Interesting stuff. All right, where are you? Well, what are you doing? Are you in the wood shop today? What do you got going on?
I'm making a second at Iron Deck chair. This one's out of cedar. As soon as I finish that one, I'll be up here in the office finishing the built-in bookcases out of oak. So just kind of petering around over the summer over small stuff.
But. Hold on, let me read you an email. Mac, first of all, cannot say thank you enough for posting the Zinni video to your website. One, I was laughing my ass off watching it. I had seen it many, many years ago, but Zinni is the best. If everybody remembers, at the time, Bill Lynn was doing nothing but annihilating the Marine Corps. And here you have certainly his intellectual equal, tested in combat a couple of different times with a ton of experience, now coming back post-regimental command to talk about maneuver warfare. And you can see Zinni takes no small amount of delight in busting Lynn's balls on repeated occasions. I thought it was awesome, but it was a great example for any of us who watched it of what a warrior scholar ought to be. Thanks for putting it up. I enjoy it because of its humor, its richness. But most of all, I think that if every regimental commander isn't giving a pitch like this, if every battalion commander isn't giving a pitch like this, if every company commander isn't giving some form of combat concepts, they're not doing their job. It's awesome. It's his conception of how we fight, and he made sure everybody knew about it. Thanks for putting it up. I watch it now at least 3 or 4 times, but thank you again. Again, you were there for me that night. It was funny when here's the guy, when he would take on Bill Lynn, you could hear everybody in the audience chuckle and laugh because, you know, the Marine Corps had gotten thumped by Bill Lynn for so long, and here's Zinni pushing back a little bit in public. It was pretty cool. And they, you know, and look, they were friends. You know, and they argued with stuff and sparred intellectually, but you can see Zinni gets a little bit of delight as playing the common man, although he's nothing of the kind, playing the common man and pushing back a little bit. But it was funny that night, and I agree. I agree with it. It was good stuff.
Yeah, well, the interesting thing about that particular PME, I think it went a long way towards helping a lot of us, make some practical application from at the schoolhouse, where of course, you know, tactics was the name of the game. TBS was responsible for writing several of the company and platoon pubs. So the implementation of maneuver warfare, you know, if it didn't start at the basic school, and you didn't have guys like, John Kelly and Zinni doing these types of things, we would have less of an idea, at least at the time, about what it meant at the tactical level, and thus not be able to teach it, other than, from an academic perspective, which, you know, you had to have those types of individuals like Bill Lynn from an academic perspective, but you also had to marry that with guys with experience, who also had an academic background, which is the best of both worlds. And I think in guys like Zinni and Ray Smith, you get that. You get the academic, you get the intellect, you get the practical experience, from which arose, on the warfare philosophy. So yeah, it's a good PME, and I agree. Not just regimental commanders, but every commander has to do some sort of getting out and talking with these leaders from a formal perspective, an informal perspective, so that when they're not together, can't communicate in a fight or in a training exercise, they can figure out what the boss wants to do without having to talk to them.
And again, it's important for you to do it as a leader because A, it forces you to distill your thoughts about A, leadership, B, command and control, C, logistics, and the major things that he talks about in that pitch that he did. If you've never seen it, watch it. It's hilarious, okay? And he constantly makes these little side comments as he's talking about one thing, and that are really, I would say in this pitch they're inflammatory. For instance, he's talking about something. And he says, yeah, you know, I had Warriors Night where I'd invite guys like Butch Neal, General Van Riper, Colonel Ripley. You know, here these guys are, shit pot full of ribbons, Silver Star, Navy Crosses, you know, great guys. And they get asked, helmets and flak jackets, you know, what do you think? And he says, and then he, then as an aside, he says, I think they're bullshit. He said, I've never seen a photo of anybody with their flak jacket zipped up and their helmet buttoned in my life. And I hear this stuff. I had mine buttoned all the time. I wore it all. He goes, that's bullshit. And so everybody's laughing. And then he says this is hilarious. And you have Colonel Ripley and you have, I don't know if Ripley was there that night, but I know Van Riper was because he was a brigadier general. He was the head of McSittich, I think, at the time. And, so he looks over and he said, they called one the Prussian. I won't name him. They called the other one the Surfer. And then he looks at Van Riper and he says, don't wax your board, General. And, he says that in front of everybody. And Van Riper was about an up as up. And now I didn't know him personally, right? He was about, he had this reputation of this incredible disciplinarian. But he, you know, shaved head when nobody was shaving their head, white guy. He looked to be the most uptight white guy on the planet. Now, I'm sure he was a warm, intellectual guy, but Zinni had a completely different vibe than they did, and I'm sure they believed in many of the same things. But it was just funny in public to watch them, you know, to watch them go back and forth. And I think it was a great example for us as younger officers about how do you do this? What does it look like? And you sat there and you saw these guys call bullshit on each other, and they did it in a professional way, and they used their humor, and it was great. It was a great example for us to kind of show us, hey, this is how smart guys do it. And so for those of us who weren't around smart guys, like Mike Etor and Phil Smith had the benefit of being around guys like Ray Smith and got raised by him. I didn't have that benefit, and so it was awesome. So anyway, all right, let's talk day three, Gettysburg. Tell me what are the major? I don't think Lee has as bad a day as everybody says he does, but we'll talk about that. What are the major pieces after day two, which is the filled with recognition prime decisions late in the afternoon, and by hook or crook, the Union saves the fight on the left flank at Little Round Top. They barely hold that position, and the Confederate Army, the Army of Northern Virginia, consolidates across the Emmitsburg Pike, and they encamp there for the night. So for the second day in a row, the Army of Northern Virginia has almost whacked them, which is in keeping with what has happened throughout most of the war. There was a few issues, and so as we meet the evening of the 2nd, what are your thoughts, Smitty, on the situation?
Yeah. Well, as we talked about a little last time, Lee's attack changed from a frontal assault on the Union right flank to more of an echelon. In other words, when Sickles pushes his Sayin out to the peach orchard, Lee sees that, and he changes from a frontal attack to more of an, it's still frontal, but it's echelon. In other words, it's timed, it's sequence from Little Round Top, and it's supposed to go in sequence down north along the pike. And the critical thing about it, everybody has to participate. So there are a couple of divisions, particularly in AP Hill's Corps, that don't support Longstreet's left as they come across. And that prevents or allows, actually, Meade to reinforce inside of his interior lines the critical spots where the attack is coming. And then, Ewell, the timing of his attack up on Cemetery Hill comes late. It's not in sequence of the echelon attack, which once again allows Howard and Slocum to pull guys off of Cemetery and Culp's Hill to meet the attack that ends up kind of on the right center of their line, or left center of their line. And as a result, the defense is able to hold. And you've got Ewell now that's back kind of in Gettysburg, still to the north and to the east a little bit. And you've got Longstreet to the south along Emmitsburg Pike, and you've got AP Hill that's going to be come up in the center and form the basis of the day three attack. Miscalculation of Lee, I think, on the second day as to exactly where, the Army of position, left flank was, caused a delay in the attack. And of course we saw the delay caused by the countermarch of Longstreet Corps. You know, a 9 o'clock attack turns into a 2 or 3 o'clock attack in the afternoon. So problems with coordination and timing, the decentralization style of command that Lee has is working for him at this particular point in time. What is interesting, though, over the evening of day two and into the morning of day three, Ewell is able to get skirmishers out into Culp's Hill. He actually pushes some folks up into the saddle between the south part of Culp's Hill and the north part of Culp's Hill. There's a saddle there just north of Spangler Springs. So there's actually Confederates on Culp's Hill in the wee hours of the morning. And then those wee hours of the morning is when Lee decides how he's going to attack on his homie on day three.
So, all right, so let's talk about the concept of the operation on day three. Go ahead. What is Lee's concept on day three?
Okay, well, before I talk about the concept, I think we need to talk a little bit about what Lee is thinking that from which he gets the concept for his attack. Okay. I think there's three things to remember, or at least think about trying to understand Lee. Remember, Lee is an attack guy. He's a Napoleonic, for lack of a better term. He understands Napoleonic history. He's been influenced by Napoleonic tactics. So he understands the striking power of the attack. He knows that he has destroyed three Union Corps at the end of day two. There's three corps that's just kind of gone. So he understands the power of the offense versus the power of the defense, at least that if you strike the hard blow at the right place in the point in time, you have the confidence and you have morale, you can be successful. So he still thinks that can work. Although you have to question his thinking about he doesn't have a success on either day one or day two. There are partial successes. The Union Army is still there. They are still allowed to resupply and those types of things. The second thing in his mind is just that. He hasn't had a conclusion to his either attack. So he turns his thoughts to his logistics. He's got 33,000 horses. The Army requires 450,000 gallons of water a day. His RD ammo resupply isn't up yet. But he understands that while he covers a lot of area around Gettysburg, his Army can forage a little bit. The guys in the defense are a little bit hampered in doing that. So he thinks, while he hasn't had a conclusive fight, that he still holds the upper hand, at least from an offensive perception. And then thirdly, He knows Meade. He doesn't want to give Meade time to move or to do much, so he has to attack again on the third day. And then he's left with, okay, I've got to attack. I don't want to give Meade time to regroup. What do I do? So in his mind, now he's attacked both wings of Meade's army. He's attacked the right flank on day one. He's attacked the left flank, although he changed it to kind of an echelon attack to get up to the center. Neither one are quite successful, but he thinks that because he's destroyed a good number of, I think the number is casualties, 20,000 so casualties at the end of day two. So they're inflicting some pretty good pain on the army of the Potomac. So he thinks that if he goes towards the hinge of the two wings, the left and the right flank, that it'll cause them to crumble upon themselves, like, you know, the crashing of a door that loses its hinge. It just comes smashing down on itself. So that's kind of what he's thinking. And then we can go into the concept of how he is going to attack the center whenever you want to do that.
The all right, so we're gonna and so give us the concept of to me what's unique about the concept of day three is, according to the foreign observers that were there, they had never seen, what is it, it's 200 and approximately 280 pieces of artillery hub to hub across Seminary Ridge. He consolidates his artillery, and he attempts to blow them off the forward slope of Cemetery Ridge. And then behind that, so the macro concept is the artillery is gonna let them have it on that forward slope, and then we will attack in concert, so Meade won't be able to move forces internally. And we'll blow a hole in the center, and we'll penetrate the center, and then we'll roll up the sides.
That's pretty much it. Yeah, it's a mass artillery, and from what I can gather, the observers there had not seen something like that because it really hadn't happened. Now, on Lee's informant of the artillery, one thing that your listeners might want to be aware of, he had reorganized his artillery since Chancellorsville. So in the month and a half or two, but since Chancellorsville, he has taken away all of his corps or army artillery. He has no more army artillery in reserve. It's all down at the corps level. So he has decentralized his artillery. He basically has no reserve artillery. But,
okay, hold on. Just explain that a little bit. Where our artillery existed before this at the corps level, and then what would exist at the army level, and how that kind of would work, because I think it's a big point in day three.
Yeah, well, just to contrast between Lee and Meade does retain army artillery reserve. It's back there by Powell Hill, got ammunition trains, and he actually pulls from them to pull artillery batteries off the line on day three, and puts new batteries up there so the older guys can go back and refit, so on and so forth. But Lee does not have a reserve artillery somewhere back behind Seminary Ridge where artillery batteries are resupplied, you know, caissons are fixed, ammunition is brought forward so that they can come back up into the fight and relieve those batteries that have been hit. So typically, what Lee would do with his army artillery prior to reorganizing it would be just that. He would have an army artillery unit, probably brigade size, and he would personally control it. He would send it where he thought he needed to send it to support his main effort, whether it be in the case of Chancellorsville, Jackson, on the left flank, or Longstreet in the defense, and Fredericksburg, so on and so forth. But he gives up that opportunity when he reorganizes and puts all the artillery down into the corps, so he loses a little bit of fire support flexibility by being able to manage it and direct it himself.
Okay. All right, so
which is the reason why you would have a reserve organization held back at the higher headquarters, so the commander seeing where the weak spots are or where success is happening can reinforce it with our children.
Right. And quickly, I want to talk about the mentality of Lee's Army. Is that I think now years later, as they begin to debate these in the Southern Historical Society papers and other and news as newspapers write analysis of the war and blah 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 blah, you know, this battle is looked at, I think, a little bit differently. What did they know at the time? What did they know at the time is that the Army of Northern Virginia, you know, they didn't have their cavalry. They stumble into Gettysburg, and on day one, they drive the Union forces from the battlefield, you know, across the city. They pursue them, and they hold themselves. They hold themselves out. In fairness to Ewell, they had marched. Some of his units had marched almost 30 miles that day, and they said,
yep.
Hey, we've done enough. And I'll tell you what. If you march 30, you're going to march 30 miles in a day and then fight uphill in Pennsylvania in July. Maybe we'll take a drink of water. In fairness to Dick Ewell, maybe we'll take a drink of water and we'll get after it tomorrow, because you know what? We've essentially kicked their ass again today. And then on day two, much of the same, there's a around the fish hook. And Culp's Hill and then Cemetery Hill, you know, they joust a bit. But on the left flank, Lee, you know, they come within a whisker of doing it. And so when they get together that night, I would say there's no sense of panic. We've got it on with these guys again. They're essentially where we want them. We've been thumping them now for 2 days, and tomorrow we're going to get our act together a little bit more. I'm going to tighten this thing up, and we're going to deliver a knockout blow. I mean, is that a fair assessment, Smitty, in terms of the mentality of the Army in Northern Virginia on the night of July 2nd?
Yeah, I think so. And from the small number of personal accounts that I've read from Confederate soldiers, that is exactly the case. They're coming off of a battlefield high out of Chancellorsville, and they want nothing more, along with you know, their hero, General Robert E. Lee, to take this fight north. So day one is, from their perspective, while it wasn't decisive, from their perspective, I think they had the confidence, they had the morale, they thought that they had the Army of the Potomac, not necessarily on the run, but they had them, you know, boxed in. And I think at the end of day two, I think the same thing is happening. Although they think it's going to take, you know, a couple more days to finish this thing. And I do think because they are right there, they can see the results of their attacks. And for those of your listeners who have been on Gettysburg, there are several places that you can be and see a good portion of the fighting and what's going on. So at the end of day two, in the early afternoon, late afternoon of day two, you can see the impact that you're having, that your infantry is having on the right flank, on your right flank and the Army of the Potomac's left flank. So I think they are in a motivated state. I think they're ready to go, and they want nothing more than to finish the fight the next day.
And then conversely, you read about the meeting that Meade holds with his corps commanders that night, and it's a fairly ominous meeting. And if you consider, they have gotten their ass kicked by the Army of Northern Virginia repeatedly. They've been outfought. They've been outmaneuvered on just about every battlefield. I mean, their victories are essentially, you know, stalemates that have been fought, which they considered, you know, victory. Lee issues at, in the aftermath of Sharpsburg, Antietam, Lee. Lincoln issues the Emancipation Proclamation, you know, and he was on McClellan's ass, you know, fight him to a draw, for God's sakes. I can't issue this thing if you keep losing it. It'll look weak. I have to do it from a position of strength. And so when they meet on the night of July 2nd, very ominous group, and they know that, and that's why I see Gettysburg as a transformational battle in the Eastern theater of the American Civil War, and that coming out of this, the Union looks at itself differently. We've taken their best. We fought with them toe-to-toe. We have the right guys where they need to be now. They did the right things. They were competent. They were competent in combat. And I think it's transformational in terms of the psyche of the Army of the Potomac. But that night, as they gather, it's a very different vibe there. It's ominous. They know that Lee's not going away. They're getting ready, and tomorrow will be another showdown with the best officer in the American military, Robert E. Lee, by everybody's account, and with an army in Northern Virginia, in Pennsylvania, and the stakes are awfully high as they go to that meeting that night. So it's pretty interesting vibe on the Union side. Your thoughts, Smitty?
Yeah, I think you're exactly right. I think there was courage in that group that night because after having been pretty well spanked, I don't know if they knew the exact numbers of the casualties that they had that day, but all they had to do was look around and see that three quarters, got spanked. So to their credit, they're going to stay because they think for several different reasons. I think because of their training. And because there's still two corps that haven't been engaged, that they can take whatever Lee's going to hand them the next day. So it does take a little bit of courage to make decisions like that, particularly a collective decision that Meade is often known for doing. Instead of making the decision based on his own observation, he gets input from all his corps commanders. And then a couple of days later, when Lee is leaving, he's going to do it again, and he's going to have a different set of corps commanders, and they're not going to want to fight. So it's just kind of a compare and contrast the situation at the time that to make that decision on the night of day two was very courageous, and I think they very easily could have chosen to leave.
But it wasn't in Lee's nature to go. But Longstreet, after the war, says he counseled him that we shouldn't fight here. We should move and find defensible terrain, which was Longstreet's nature. He believed in the tactical defense, and then allow the Union to come towards them and smoke them from superior positions. But Lee was not of that mindset. Let's talk about artillery here again. The lining is artillery essentially across from the center of the Union position on Cemetery Ridge. Lee puts his artillery to work. After the war, there's discussion about did not have enough ammunition, blah, 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 blah. Your thoughts on that discussion, Smitty?
Yeah, somewhat difficult to resupply the Confederate artillery because what the Corps commanders do, because they now have and are in charge of the deployment of their own artillery. If you look at it on a map post-battle, the artillery is all on the line along Seminary Ridge. They're not masked by a battery. Their fires are going to be masked on the copse of trees. So to resupply, if you had a resupply organization, which Pleasanton was in charge of, if you had massed artillery in one spot, you could more easily resupply them. But because they're spread out over the battlefield, and because you don't have an army reserve, the resupply structure and process is somewhat hampered. And I think I may have mentioned it a few minutes ago, the artillery resupply train that Pleasanton, who is the Army artillery guy that Lee has not moved out of. They're still in Winchester. On day two, they're still in Winchester. They're not going to get up until it's going to take them 2 days to get there from Winchester. So yes, they are going to be short of ammunition for this artillery massed fire exercise that they're going to do on day three, and they're not going to have enough.
Okay, so the concept is on the flanks, Ewell and Longstreet will engage. The decisive blow will fall in the center under A.P. Hill, and it will be A.P. Hill taking it to Hancock near the copse of trees after, and they will penetrate there after a artillery barrage, again, unheard of in the American Civil War in terms of the amount of artillery getting poured into a point. And then after that, Hill will close and penetrate, and then they'll roll the shoulders back, and they'll be done with this. That's the concept, yeah?
Right. Okay. Right. And the one thing to remember is that in Lee's mind, he wanted it to be all simultaneous. The supporting attacks by Ewell, the supporting attacks by Longstreet, and A.P. Hill were all supposed to happen at the same time in order to prevent Meade from moving units and organization around on his interior lines. And if it didn't happen simultaneously, Meade would once again be allowed to reinforce areas where he needs to. So that was the other part of the concept. And we haven't talked about what Stuart is doing, but he has a role to play on day three. Your listeners may need to be reminded that Stuart just gets to Gettysburg on the night. I think it's, 2300 or so at night.
Right, late.
Before, Stuart actually physically meets up with Lee. There are some things that are said, but one of the things that Lee says to him is, "Hey, now you got to help me get at these people." So his design.
Lee, I'll tell you what, if there's ever a guy that should have got his ass chewed, it was Stuart. Right?
Yeah.
But Lee doesn't do it. Lee likes him. He's his boy, and he doesn't do it. And it's not arguably one of the great blunders of the American Civil War. Is Lee Betts' victory on this movement, and he trusts Stuart to get to where he's supposed to be. Stuart can't do it, and as a result, Lee stumbles in, quote unquote stumbles into an engagement in Gettysburg, and so as a result, I would have chewed Stuart's ass, and I'd say, "Get that feather out of your hat. You better get your shit together, because I'd like to kill you right now." And but he, in one of the in terms of the Eastern Theater anyway, I think it might be the largest cavalry engagement on the eastern side of the Civil War, and on the other side, very prominent is a lieutenant colonel of the 1st Michigan by the name of George Armstrong Custer. Custer fights in every major battle of the Civil War with the Army of Potomac. And comes out. He's a very interesting. If you read biographies of him, he's this charismatic young leader, and he's kind of like Douglas MacArthur, right? He does crazy stuff, but everybody else around him gets shot, but he doesn't get a scratch. And his troopers start calling it Custer's luck, and they start wearing. He wore a red scarf. They start wearing a red scarf. And because this guy, right, we're going to, the cavalry is going to charge these artillery batteries, right? Boom, they boom the flechette round. Everybody goes down except the dude with the long blonde hair. He's like, "Where'd everybody go? Come on." And they're like, "This Custer guy's crazy. I mean, he never gets hit. What the hell?" But he's one of those guys with a magical bubble around him. And his reputation in the Civil War and at the end of the Civil War was that of a competent, charismatic leader. His reputation has taken a 180 since then, but at the time he's very charismatic, and he's part of the Union cavalry that fight north of Gettysburg in an open plain up there against Jeb Stuart. And
that's one of the things that Stuart is supposed to do is protect Ewell's left flank, and then do some kind of supporting diversionary attack in the rear of Meade's army over there to try to pull some forces out of the defense. But of course, the Union cavalry under Pleasanton, they all do a good job of keeping Stuart pinned down. So whatever it is that Stuart does out there, it's ineffective primarily because of Union cavalry, of which Custer is a part of.
And again, what you see here is, you know, this is the third time we've done this, but what you see here is there's an opportunity. If Stewart can deal with Pleasanton quickly, he can get into Meade's rear and cause havoc, or at least threaten, or get it planted in Meade's head that I may have to use my reserve to go deal with that guy because I can't have him in my rear, you know, wreaking havoc on my combat trains, whatever. And that doesn't happen because Pleasanton stands up and holds Stewart in check. All right, let's talk about the execution itself. First part is the sync matrix falls apart.
Yep, it sure does. What happens up on the Union right flank at Cemetery Hill and Culp's Hill is that Ewell knows what the instructions are. He is to attack in daylight simultaneously with AP Hill and Longstreet. The enemy gets a vote, so Meade, Howard and Slocum up there, they all decide to attack early into Cemetery Hill and Culp's Hill. So that upsets the timing for Ewell because nothing has started down on the center. We'll talk a little bit about why things aren't happening down on Longstreet then in just a few minutes. But what sets this whole thing in motion, I think, is the Union attack back into Cemetery Hill and Culp's Hill because Johnson and Early are up there messing around trying to get onto that terrain. They know the importance of that terrain. So they're, you know, the Confederates are preparing for the attack when Slocum and Meade's boys, not Meade, Howard, who is still there off Cemetery Hill, attack them to regain the high ground of Cemetery Hill initially, and then Culp's Hill a little bit later in the morning. So that upsets the whole timing of the thing. The other thing that's happening is that Longstreet is in a pissy mood. We talked a little bit before about how he kind of drags his feet on day two, doesn't want to attack a flank. He wants to do this envelopment thing. So now he still has that in the back of his mind, that there's still an opportunity to take his corps around the big round top and get around behind Meade. So he actually, in his mind, and by some actions that he takes, he actually disobeys Lee because he is not ready to go at 9 o'clock in the morning. He hasn't even started to prepare his corps, for a simultaneous concurrent attack with AP Hill and Ewell. So now Lee is in a dilemma. What does he do? Well, he basically can't do anything until, you know, he waits for Longstreet to get orders out to his guys, to get positions and so on and so forth. But that is the second thing that happens that messes with the timeline, at least in Lee's mind, that he had set for a simultaneous attack on both wings, both flanks, and then in the center.
Lee's got some leadership issues in his command. Longstreet comes out of this vilified after the Civil War. He does not fare well after the Civil War relative to this criticism. Lee comes out a saint. Longstreet, not so much. All right, so the lack of sync is one thing. My own opinion, my own personal opinion is this. There was ample artillery. If Lee's artillerymen hammer the forward slope of that hill, that they would have penetrated the center of that position. That's my own, with all of its flaws, the thunderous right hook that Lee threw into the body of the Union force there would have been ample for Pickett to then penetrate had the artillery done its job. So
yeah, well, that I think that's a fair critique, but you got to remember Lee also changed the purpose for artillery in this on day three. He did not intend for the artillery to target the infantry on the forward slope. He wanted artillery versus artillery, and once again, this is a throwback to his Napoleonic history is, you know, get rid of the artillery that's going to slow down and impede the advance of my fighting power, my striking blow. So that's really what he's after, is trying to artillery versus artillery, and the Union artillery almost take the bait, and the Union artilleryman, who was at Hunt,
yep.
It was Hunt, yeah. He goes around and he plays a good role in telling these artillery batteries and brigades not to, you know, take the bait. Don't shoot at their artillery. Let's wait until the boys and the infantry get here so that you can have good effect. But there are a lot of personal reports where the Union artillery commanders were anxious to get in the fight. So just as soon as Confederate artillery, you know, unleashes at 1 o'clock, a lot of them are going to return fire, and as a result, deplete a lot of their ammunition until Hunt gets up there and tells them to cease fire, wait. So it, from both perspectives, both Confederate and Union on the artillery, they both, at the end of this fight, are pretty much depleted with the artillery ammunition for different reasons. But nonetheless, it's not a done deal with regards to artillery. But I just wanted to kind of explain that, you know, the purpose for the artillery from Lee's perspective changes. So that's why you don't see a lot of infantry casualties on day three from the artillery, because they're targeting, trying to find and depress and destroy artillery.
Okay, now I understand that, but their targets still weren't on the reverse slope, which is where much of the artillery landed in the combat trams of the Army of the Potomac. So whether you're shooting artillery batteries, or we haven't found them, we can't see them, we're still shooting. This prep is still going. So shoot something, right? Secondary target would have been
right. Infantry.
But the artillery was ineffective. And so to me, given all of its flaws, so to me, you know, the pain, what is the painting? The forlorn hope, right?
You know,
Bonnie George Pickett, right? With his cover on his sword. Come on, boys! You know, and he wanted his moment of glory and blah, 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 all the theatrics. All of that aside, what Lee engineers that day is a powerful hook with a confident army. And they don't execute. They don't execute any of it well that day.
Yeah, I'd agree.
And, so, and I've got an email, which is kind of what I was just speaking to. Mac, don't you think Pickett's charge was doomed from the start? No, I don't. If you understand how it was conceived and how he used fire support with that, no, I don't think. Lee wasn't a stupid guy, and if you think he's stupid, I think you have to put yourself in his position and look at what you got and look at what he did, and you'll find that normally he's pretty smart, pretty shrewd guy. And I think on this day, too. I think on this day, too, he had come close 2 days prior, you know, and if we can pin these guys down, if Stewart can finally contribute here, that'll be a good thing. But make no mistake, I'm going to line up more artillery they've ever seen. I'm going to throw a blow that they've never seen the likes of, and Pickett's going to go in. We're going to penetrate the center, and we're going to peel this thing out, and they're going to be running back to someplace in eastern Pennsylvania, maybe Washington, D.C., but they're not going to stay here. And I think that's the end. As Mindy said, you know, his nature was to be offensive. And he had gone to Pennsylvania looking for the decisive blow. He almost got it yesterday, and he's going to get it today. And I think that's the mentality of the Army of Northern Virginia. Now, again, one of the things I say, which makes Gettysburg so interesting, is the command of the Army of Potomac has changed. You have Hancock on the other side, who's not flinching a bit. Right.
And
they're more than a match for Pickett. So, but this is all going on simultaneous, right? And so it's the dynamic of combat. And again, I mean, can you imagine when Warren gets to Meade's tent that night, and Meade looks at him and says, "How'd it go?" And Warren says, we were within seconds of losing, literally seconds of losing today. I mean, that would put your stomach in a knot. They almost got to our flank, and we'd all be running right now, literally.
Yep.
So,
the other problem that the Confederates had is to the question of was Pickett's charge doomed? Was I think there was pretty good consensus that they could make it to the Casa Tree. They could make it to Cemetery Ridge. The problem that I think several of the commanders expressed was staying there after they got there.
Right.
Which then goes to, what did you have in reserve, the timing of the attack from the left and right. It goes back to the plan. If the wings aren't being attacked simultaneously as the center, you won't be able to stay there because it allows Meade, Hancock, and the boys to redistribute forces as an untimed attack is coming at them. So,
which is ultimately what happened. I mean, what happens is Pickett is a Virginian, and the North Carolinians suffered greatly, much more. Pettigrew and his division suffer far in excess of what happens to Pickett, although Pickett has a very emotional response to the whole thing. But what happens is essentially they get into a fire sack. And they get hammered from all sides, essentially, because of the lack of concert by the Army of Northern Virginia. Smitty, about.
And then you've got the North Vermonters down there who came out and came off the line and turned to by the right flank and fired into the right flank of Pickett and those boys. So it wasn't just all the fire to their front. They were getting it from the flank there because of the initiative of a couple of brigade and regimental commanders there in the line. So that was good stuff.
If you look at a map for day three, it is pretty amazing. Those guys, what they got into. I mean, honestly, they got their heads kicked in that day, and it was not a good event for the Army of the Potomac that day. I'm sorry, for the Army of Northern Virginia that day.
Northern Virginia, yeah.
In execution, and you can imagine after the Union Army has been gotten thumped, they see the artillery fires has doesn't have great effect. And then now here come the infantry, and now our artillery that hasn't paid a big price yet. Now it's gonna jump into the battle, and they do, and they start wearing Pickett's ass out as he's coming across that and Pettigrew. They start blasting holes in those formations, and then after that, now they come into rifle range, and then they start paying a price for that. And it is, and then you can imagine on the Union side, after they've got their asses thumped and thumped and thumped, now, hey boys, it's our turn. They're gonna pay. And pay they did. But, again, an incredible, battle. Smitty, final thoughts on, either the lasting impact of Gettysburg or do you view the battle differently today than you did when you started studying it? Give me some final thoughts.
No, I don't think my perspective has changed. I think the Union Army had a chance to win the war right there. But Meade doesn't see it that way. I think he's a very tactical-oriented individual. He's not the war winner. So his objective is to protect Washington, so he's not going to chase after Lee out.
When you say they had the opportunity to win, you mean they win on day three. If they pursue him to the river, Lee's faced with trying to ford a river.
Yep. He's got a whole corps that hasn't been in the fight yet. Six corps still not in the fight. He could have sent them after Lee on day four, day five in the rain while he's trying to recoup. and took care of them. I mean, they were done. I mean,
but again, I will tell you this. I think on the night of day two, I mean, those guys had to be scared shitless. Is this going to happen again? And then they win on day three, but essentially they repulse Pickett's charge on day three, but they don't really know they've won, right?
That's right. Yeah, that's right.
Because they're like, well, what's he going to do now? Right? Because Lee's the guy. He's the guy who's dictating the fight in spite of not having Stewart initially. Now when Lee leaves, you know, what is Meade's reaction? They look around, they're like, hey, we did okay. We're still here. But we've got our head kicked in the last, you know, we suffered substantial casualties. And, you know, again, it's a different fight. You would have liked to have said that Meade should have, like, said, yeah, pursue him.
Well, all he had to do was, understand what Lincoln was trying to do, which is destroy Lee's army. I mean, that was well communicated via Halleck, down to Meade. So Meade just had to have a little bit of gumption and take a day's rest,
right.
Maybe take 2 days rest.
And then get
out. On day seven, I mean, he's all about taking Lee back across the Potomac. He's not going to let Lee establish well-defended 2, 3, 4, 5 half-dozen crossing points across the Potomac River between Falls River and Williamston, you know, the space of 3 miles. Don't let him get away. Come on.
No. And let me tell you.
It would have been over.
At a minimum, Buford and the Union Cavalry, Pleasanton and that whole crew should have been all over those fording sites, should have been making them deploy and fight to the greatest extent they could to slow them down, to contest their movement, and then after a day's rest, as you said, we're going to get after it. So, and again, there were forces that Meade had that had not been greatly committed in that fight and greatly taxed that he could have task organized with the, he could have task organized with the cavalry to put enough pressure on Lee to slow his movement down, which would then lend itself to possibly the destruction of the Army of Northern Virginia north of the river in subsequent days. So, interesting.
Yep.
What's your favorite favorite part to study, most interesting piece of the battle?
I mean, Gettysburg?
Yep.
I think day two is the day that that the Confederates lost it. It wasn't day three. It was day two. Or in reverse, it was a day that the Army of the Potomac, you know, held ground, and they were good to go for day three, regardless of what Lee was going to do on day three. It was day two that set up the failure, if there is to be a failure, for Lee's attack into northern Pennsylvania to take the fight out of Virginia. That was the thing on day two.
My favorite, the part I've enjoyed the most, and very much, in fact, the book I got when I left IOC was from everybody that is signed, is that I have here. It's written by Oliver Norton. He was Strong Vincent's guidon bearer, and he writes a book after the war called Little Round Top or something like that, and it chronicles their movement back into Pennsylvania. They were from Pennsylvania, and what that felt like, and what kind of guy Vincent was. A Harvard-educated lawyer who rose quickly after he enlisted in the United States Army, and it talks about his decision making, which I've always enjoyed studying, and how he's sitting on the backside of the wheat field and sees this courier. And the courier's got a message from Warren to General Barnes, who he can't find, saying, "Bring somebody here." Now, if Vincent doesn't intervene and say, "What do you have? Who are you looking for?" And those 5 minutes are significant in the nation's history. And so, it's just interesting to me, decision windows that open and close, people that take action and take decisive action that influence events in huge ways. And Vincent, you know, although Joshua Lawrence Chamberlain, you know, the Lion of Little Round Top and all of that, Strong Vincent gets killed on that mountain and ultimately is the guy who makes the decision to take a brigade up there that contests Hood and McLaws' advance down in that direction, and ultimately gives the Union enough time to pivot in that direction and defend itself. So I find that stuff riveting, as I do in most battles that I study. Decision makers, where they come from, where were they, why that day, and I find it riveting stuff. So anyway.
All right, you can't go wrong studying the personalities and characteristics of leaders at Gettysburg on any of the days. It's just rich with on both sides, decision makings and what goes into the making of a decision in the heat of battle. I mean, you just can't go wrong studying it for any purpose.
And for guys like us who you know, we would take lieutenants up there to be able to use firsthand sources and things like that, and to see them sitting on a battlefield in the same place that something happened, reading somebody saying, "I wasn't sure what was happening in yonder stream because of the smoke of the artillery," you know, and then to have a lieutenant say something like, "That's the same thing I feel when I'm doing something. I don't feel like I really know what's going on." And then you're the teaching point is you're not going. That's get familiar with that, because you're not going to, and you got to act in that with less than perfect information. And it's almost like they feel this sense of relief. Oh, really? Okay. Yeah, he felt it too. And then you read the rest of the story, as Paul Harvey would say. So, well, Smitty, first of all, we got to come up with another battle to study. So I'll give you a call and we'll figure something out, and if you don't mind, we'll continue our study of military history together.
Yeah, that'd be great.
All right.
Enjoy.
Phil Smith. Thanks, buddy. Appreciate it.
My pleasure.
There you have it. Phil Smith from Texas A&M. That's right. That'll do it. I'm over by a few minutes, maybe 27 of them. What the hell? Come on, man. How does that happen? Anyway, my thanks. Interesting day. George Marshall. MarshallFoundation.org. Now I got to go find George Marshall stuff. I wonder if there's any video of him speaking or in any kind of long format that's out there. If there is, I'm going to find it. All right. My thanks to Dr. Rob Havers for coming on. And you can find the information about George Marshall, MarshallFoundation.org. You go there, they have a research library, they have a tab for the museum, education, the foundation, news events. If you want to donate, you can do that, or shop, you can do that as well. So my thanks to him for coming on. Phil Smith and Gettysburg, if you can't tell, I'm a fan. Like us on Facebook, follow us on Twitter, tell your friends about us. Thanks for making us part of your morning today. Have a great afternoon. This program repeats itself momentarily, so don't touch that dial. On a Wednesday, All Marine Radio, out.